Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you have done.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2757. That's 2757. Tonight is a question and answer night, your Q&A. You call in and we can discuss something that might be on your mind, okay, something you need to discuss with someone. And we have Pastor Deborah Schleck here. And then also, too, we also have, family members. I see John is here. I'm very happy to see him here. And, of course, I'm here. And so we are looking for, something that maybe you would like to discuss, because that's the real issue of this show on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It's for people to call in, and now she has quite a background. In fact, we all do here on this panel. But I'm going to give out the telephone number, 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118, okay? Before we go any further, though, I'm going to read the NASCA mission statement here. And the reason being that we read this is so that people who are not familiar with what we do, they'll become familiar with a little of what we do, okay? Now, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse sponsors the Stop Child Abuse Now show, and that's what we're about to start here. It says, we have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse, okay, and trauma including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. And number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay, prevention, intervention, and recovery. Now, you've heard me say many times, I don't know if I introduce myself. I do that a lot. I'm Carol Levine, and I am Vice President of NASCA. But anyway, We do speak about prevention, intervention, and recovery. Why do we do that? The reason we do that is because, all right, now this is my humble opinion here. If we had a lot more people who understood prevention, then just maybe we could put that dent in the statistics that we're always speaking about, okay, the dent in the statistics. If we could teach the parents how to, speak to their children, that's assuming they come from normie homes, okay, about prevention, what to look for, and so forth, they could then pass it on to their children. And believe me, your children will respect you for this because you build a bond by doing that. Mommy and Daddy care enough about me to want to educate me, to help me, to know what to look for and what not to look for. Okay, this is not to scare your child, but to educate your child, because we live in a world where you need all the education you can get, okay? We have people out there that just simply are bad people, they're sick people, and whichever order you want to put that in. And children need to be aware, because children most often are their prey, and that's P-R-E-Y, that's not P-R-A-Y. You pray for them after they get caught or get abducted or whatever, but the prey is what they're looking for, and that's P-R-E-Y, okay? So I bring this up because, okay, intervention teaches you how, you know, to speak to your child. Now, if you go on our NASCA website, that's NAASCA.org, that's NASCA.org, and scroll down just a little bit, just a little bit, you'll see red lines that go across, and each red line mentions what you're going to be clicking onto and opening. On the left-hand side all the way to the far left is are actually programs that people can join, and it goes from there, okay? And now under prevention, intervention, and recovery, we have all different kinds of articles that teach you how to speak to your children. A lot of times adults are bashful about speaking about sexual abuse or perverts out there. They don't know how to. So therefore, what they do is, and what they need, I should say, is something like what we offer here at NASCA. We have wonderful articles there, one by David Pittman. It's very good. And he suggests that parents role play, okay? They role play before they even address their children. And then we speak also, too, about what ages do you speak to your children about, you know, sex? And also, too, about pedophiles. Well, that can vary, but the experts do suggest that, you know, first of all, when you're giving your child a bath, a lot of times they'll say, Mommy, what is this, or Daddy, what is that, and so forth and so on. And that's a good thing, okay, because then there shows that they're taking an interest in their body, and they want to know, you know, just what these things are and what's the function of them, okay? So if you read, you know, like articles that we have right on our website, it teaches you how, age appropriately, how to speak to your child. And then your child has no more questions, you know, I mean, they'll have some, but you know what I'm saying, they've gotten an idea, and they'll learn, too, what the red flags are, you know, of the pedophiles. And this is very, very important. We're survivors. And who better to teach our children than we, if you think about it? You don't want them to learn the hard way, like a lot of us did. You don't want them to learn out on the schoolyard. They'll probably get improper information anyway. You know, it's better if the parents build that bond between their child and themselves, and knowing that they can go to them anytime, okay, if something bad happens. So that's an important thing right there. So I want to give out the number again, 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. Now tonight, again, as I had mentioned, we do have a Pastor Deborah, oops, there's the page here, Schleck, who, and she grew up all over the world in a military family where her mother was mentally ill and is now a survivor professional. She's living in Florida. She's a trained minister. She's worked at mental health also, working with substance abuse, and is a trauma-informed social worker. And she's all those things together. And she volunteers her time in the community and the organizations. She's done a lot of presentations. She just does an awful lot of different things. So that's who's on board tonight. So if you have any questions that you'd like answered, you can call this number. And she's here, John's here, I'm here, and hopefully there'll be more here. A lot of people listen through their computer, and that's okay. I was asked today if they could listen through the computer, because a lot of times they're bashful about coming on air. So, all right, listen away. But at any time, you know, call, push the number one, and you can come on and you can ask your own questions. It says here she teaches that humans have three parts, and that's being of spirit, soul, and the physical body, and believes that all three are important, and each one of these areas need care. Okay. So I've read enough about her. And Deborah, you were mentioning something a little bit earlier about what you were talking about, you and I were speaking about before the show started. And then I, too, want to get in because I have things from the Mayo Clinic that should be addressed to those who are not survivors. Remember, we have all kinds of people that listen to our show. It's not just the survivors. That's easy, okay? We have people who are listening in tonight that I know don't know too much about child abuse. So anyway, okay. What was it you wanted to discuss? And then I'll go to John and see if there's something that he may want to discuss.
Okay. This is Pastor Deborah. With the COVID that's going on, a lot of people are wearing masks, and they can be bring up some memories for a survivor of having a hand over their mouth or having to, not being able to breathe. Panic attacks can happen. And what you have to learn how to do is maybe look at the mask and say, you're not the hand. You're not going to hurt me. I'm not going to die. I can breathe. It's a lot of internal talking to yourself. I'm not a child anymore. I'm not breathe. And so some people need to learn that technique of talking to themselves about the mask and saying, I'm not going to die. I'm wearing this to be safe. This is not the hand that was held over my mouth. I'm going to be okay. This is for my protection and other people's protection. And then afterwards, you can always wash the mask, throw it away. But during the time you're wearing it, it's very uncomfortable. If you wear glasses, they fog up. You know, some of them don't fit, and we're not used to being hindered in our movement, our breathing, even just talking to people. I noticed that out on different social medias. Everybody wants to know how you're feeling and what your opinions are and how do you think about this. And we're not used to regulating ourselves. And we're not used to saying, hey, people don't need to know everything. I don't have to answer every question. But we have to do a lot of self to ourselves, talk to ourselves privately when we're at home, what the mask is for, what it's trying to do. We could, if you were spiritual, you could pray over the mask. Say, you're my friend. You're not here to hurt me. We are going to be in a partnership together so you can help keep me safe. Okay, it's not the hand that was over my mouth. So you do some things like that. And then when you get back in your car or something, take the mask off, you say, thank you, mask. Thank you, soul, that I was able to wear it and do my business and, you know, go shopping or whatever I do. And sometimes you just need to be quiet. And you don't need to talk. And we have learned, I think, a lot about hand sanitizer and they said a lot of people are not getting colds like they used to because we're not talking as much. We're not sneezing outside of our mask. It's not going. We're becoming a little more conscious of germs and viruses and our own health and other people's health, which typically most humans, they don't think about that. So that was one thing during these days. We may be wearing masks for many years to come. Some people may never take them off, other people, you know. And so we have to come to a relationship with the mask. And if you've had issues of sexual abuse as a child, it can be very frightening. I saw that a lot in scuba diving. People going to put on a mask and go under in the swimming pool, and they would get claustrophobic, feel like things were closed in. And they had to work through that with the instructor. And so some people may have those kind of feelings, and they can't breathe, and they're not free. And those are things, if you're having a therapist or a pastor or a close friend, or you could call, you know, NASCA, and you could talk to people how you feel about, you know, wearing the mask and how it triggers you and the memories that spring it up. So you have to do some work within yourself so that when you put the mask on to be safe from the virus and not to spread your germs to other people, that the triggers don't come up, that you know this has nothing to do with my childhood abuse. I'm not going to die. I can breathe through it. I'm not being abused. So there's some issues for some people, you know, why they don't wear it. And it is uncomfortable. I can tell you that. You wear glasses, it's more uncomfortable. A lot of children, they're pretty much accepted, you know. But that would be something that if you were having difficulties, that either NASC or somebody on the contact list could help you with, if you're seeing a therapist, you know, you could discuss it with them. And a lot of people might be having trouble with that or shaking someone's hand again or something like that. And there is something in mental health counseling where people are afraid of germs. I think one of the ones that most of us heard about was Howard Hughes. He was so afraid of dying or getting something. He locked himself behind rooms, you know. And we can become afraid of germs and viruses of shaking somebody's hand. Then there's other people that have no idea. They don't really care. You know, they're going to be free and you can't tell them what to do. And they aren't going to follow the rules and things like that. So for a survivor, you have to assess yourself, maybe discuss it with a friend, somebody else who understands, you know, what the childhood abuse was like, if there was a hand covering your mouth, or if you were even told, be still, you held your breath, you know, when things were happening, you couldn't breathe, you felt like you were just being suffocated, and a lot of putting a mask on in many different ways maybe may trigger some of those memories that come up that you haven't had in a long time that need to be dealt with and that they'll need to have some type of sort of reconciliation or peace treaty with the mask. And keep telling
peace treaty with the mask. I like that.
Well,
I like that. Was pretty good.
I'm not a child anymore. I'm not going to die. I'm not being abused. I can breathe through the mask. Now, there are some masks, I think, that might be easier to breathe through and receive air. There's all kinds of masks. So you may have to experiment with different ones that you feel comfortable in. Some might want to. Wearing a black one might remind them of their abuser. Okay, it was at nighttime, his shirt was black, versus those blue ones or a white one or a homemade one. So you learn to experiment what doesn't trigger you. So that was what I was thought would be important to bring up.
That is important, Deborah. And you know, I don't know how I feel about all of this because you hear so many different things from so many different people, and they're all supposed to be experts, okay? And I think in cases like that, now, like in my particular case, and I do not advocate this for anyone, okay? You guys know how I am. All right, I don't advocate this one. I happen to be at a party. It was a very tiny party. This happened about a year ago now. And some of my friends, we were together. And as it turned out, three of them were positive, and they didn't know it. Now, I broke bread with them. I spent many hours with them. I was having a fine time with them. And within 2 days, they became very, very ill. One was on oxygen. And next step would have been a ventilator because she also had COPD. The other two just became very, very ill. And I don't mean just. I mean, they were very, very ill. Didn't go into the hospital, though. And then there was me. I didn't get anything. I think I scared the blasters away. That's what I think. You know, I had nothing. Now, what I do, and I'm not saying that other people have to be like me, if I always have a mask with me, and if I feel comfortable, fine, but if I don't feel comfortable, I put the mask on. And there are some stores, like there was one today, I had to go in and get some medical supplies for my son. But anyway, it said in right on the door, wear a mask, period. Okay, that it, you know, they wanted you to wear a mask. So anyway, okay, so I certainly pulled my mask out and I put it on. Now, I've been tested 3 times. I do not have COVID. And I finally did get the shots because I call them shots. I feel like a dog. The vaccines, okay? Because the reason being is because I have lost 3 friends recently. Not the people I was just speaking about. 3 other friends. One was a teenager from high school I hung out with. We signed together in New York. And the other 2 were just friends of mine. This is scary. It all of a sudden hit home. It hit home. Okay, so I figured, oh, what the heck, I'll stick my arm out, let them give me a shot. I had no problems with the shots. I had one day where I felt a little dizzy with shot number 1, but I figured that could be my sinuses. A lot of times you hear me gravelly. I have terrible sinus trouble. Excuse me, and it gets in the way at times, especially when I want to sing. Now, the second shot, my arm was sore, so what? But, you know, it was sore for 1 day. That was it. And I felt a little flu-like, but that was it for 1 day. Now they say you can get, you know, still get infected even with the shot. So this is what I'm saying. People are in an upset, you know, are upset because they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. They think they're doing the right thing by getting the shots. There's a lot of stress out there. A lot of aggravation. Some of my friends, you don't dare talk to them about it, or they won't talk to you. Okay. It actually has gone that far. And, you know, everyone has their own opinions, because you had mentioned that they have, you know, a lot of, there are people that do nothing, okay? And yes, there are. But I think we, as being a free country that we are, we have to make, and we're still free. I mean, a lot of things are happening that I don't like. I can't get political. I could talk for 2 hours on it, but I won't. But the point is that we, so far as somewhat of a free society, because some of the things that we were free in before, we don't have anymore. But we can still make our own minds up about that. So here you go back. I was with many people, and I was with some people who were very, very, very sick, and one almost died. Excuse me, and then the others, I have 3 that did die, okay? So I don't know what to think about the shots. As far as what you were saying, then I'm going to get to John. With the hand over the mouth, yes, I had that happen to me as a child with the pedophile uncle that I lived with, and he would put his hand over my mouth because I would resist, and then he twisted my arm so badly one day he almost broke my wrist. And so forth, and I knew that I couldn't do that anymore. But now I personally don't have a problem with wearing a mask, but there are some people that do, and they have asked me the same thing, Deborah, you know, about the mask issue, and they feel like they go back in their mind, you know, like they have like a flashback or something as to the hand being over their mouth. So depends on the person. Go ahead, John. What do you have to say about all this?
First of all, thank you all for having me here tonight. It's nice to hear your voice there, Pastor Deb. I'm John Anderson. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Yeah, I mean, as far as the mask go, it's kind of crazy down here. I'm from New Orleans, okay? And I just went to a concert, and you could not get up and go anywhere without that mask on your face. And they would tell you to put it on, or you were going to leave, basically. But once you sat down in the seat, it was okay to take it off, you know. So it is what it is, you know. And you go to, like, pharmacies, right, small convenience stores. Now, if it's a small convenience stores, I noticed that people don't wear them at all, usually. But you go to, yeah, pharmacy, you know, doctor's office, somewhere, you know, like a grocery store. I notice a lot of people still wearing, but there's a few that aren't, you know. So I don't know how long they're going to keep that going. But, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. But I can't wait to talk about some other stuff with you, though, once
all
we
right,
move on
go
from
ahead.
This. I have,
you can
well,
go,
if,
you can
if,
ask.
If it's okay, can I just move on to that?
Yes,
I got a couple questions.
Yeah, do that. Yeah, do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm just noticing a lot of stuff. I've been reading your bio and read your story. Boy, I mean, you are really, really experienced in a lot of areas, you know, that I notice. And I wanted to ask you one question in specific. You know, I'm reading about, and I hope it's not too much of a tender subject for you. If you don't want to speak about it, I understand. But I'm reading about your mom, okay? And the fact that you grew up in military family, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then now I'm looking at, you know, your where you are today and how far you've come from that time. How old were you when that happened? When you were with your mom about that time in the military family? And she was, you said she was mentally ill, right?
Yeah, what happened was when I was born, my brother was 4 years older. And probably right from the start, he started being jealous of me because I didn't know a lot of what was going on, you know, for a while. But there were fights. And she was very a chain smoker in the house. And, you know, back then in the 50s, it was pretty much everywhere. So I was sick a lot, sinus infections, strep throats. I went through the chicken pox, the measles. And you didn't, she stayed home and didn't work. And my dad was in the military, and we moved every 2 years. My brother did not do well with that because he needed attachments. I was fine for some reason. I liked meeting new people. But what I learned, how it happened, I mean, I went through it. My dad was a psychologist, but he couldn't do anything, was they would get in arguments. She'd never ask forgiveness. I'd beg my dad. There was crying. My brother was running away when I'm like 8. What was 4 became 3. And nobody, there was no counseling. I called the suicide line. You don't know what to do. So I would retreat to the Bible, retreat to listening to wonderful Elvis Presley music and seek peace. I went to church. Even if nobody took me, I'd walk 5 miles. So I was sort of totally ignorant. And how it came about was when my mother was dying in my living room. My brother said, as he's sitting next to her, I feel like she's abandoning me and rejecting me again. I'm going, she's dying. She can't help it. He says, I can't help. That's how I feel. So I started seeking through God, what was going on? What had happened? And I had found out through some people from the deep in the occult that I found out my mother did not like her sisters. She had 2 or 3 others, was jealous of them. Her father died, and she blamed her mom. And she brought all that bitterness and anger into the marriage. And she got married, and she's going to keep her husband, okay? And in the, as an officer's family, the officer, the man, had to do a lot of parties, so we had a lot of babysitters. And I grew up in the, 50s, okay? So then what happened is when she died, when she was about 74, I had to start looking back, and I found out from some people in the cult what sort of happened was on my father's side. He was from Northern Ireland. And I do some great teaching with people. You must understand your ancestors. You must go back three and four. There was a lady in Northern Ireland who had sex with a satanic druid priest. She had a firstborn, a boy. She wanted to keep it. Well, the druid wanted it to sacrifice it. And she made a deal with the priest, and, of course, at that time with whoever the priest, Satan or something, that he could have her grandson or her lineage in 4 generations. And that was my brother. And what they did is they used my mother's, we'll call it mental illness issues, to reject, because how it worked is my dad would go off to Saudi Arabia for a year. on a company tour. And it was just my, this was before I was born, just my brother and my mom. And then this stranger comes home, and his mommy wants to go off with him. So he got abandoned with babysitters, rejected. That went on. And then I got born, and she has to spend time with me. So he's getting abandoned and rejected. And I can remember there were so many fights. He'd come home. He's got a mustache. You ain't going to come home to a military. He's kicked out. No holidays were ever pleasant. He would run away, get thrown in jail. Nobody's talking, no counseling. I didn't know, but I learned later what happened. He was the one that this, we'll call it curse, this deal fell to in this family. And they used the issues of my mother, who had legitimate issues, and she went through menopause horribly. And if you're in the military, you don't talk. There's a code of silence probably in the police and everywhere else. So she got no help. And she was on no medication, but she was suicidal, jumping out of cars with me in it, running away from home, no counseling, no family, no nothing. My dad was great. He protected me. He would send me off. I'll take care of her. So I survived. They're all dead now. But I learned they went to work on my brother from this lady four generations back, using my mother's issues in the family, but she brought into it. I escaped it, but it was, you know, a living hell when you're growing up. Felt like my mother didn't have a full deck of cards. I really had very little support, didn't, felt like an only child, and she was obsessed with her hair and smoking, and you know, the only thing that saved me was I went after peace. I would seek solitude. I stayed by myself a lot, still love it, would go to church, read the Bible, and somehow I came through it okay. And so I tell my story, you know, and we have to look back at our parents who did things, we'll say, in child abuse. They had probably things done to them. Travels to families, okay? They talk about genes, okay? They talk about culture. They talk about religion. There's code of ethics for families and certain jobs, okay? They used to have, back in the 1920s, I think, a lot of your Christian women went on a lot of trying to get alcohol, do you remember, I think it was called prohibition, to be stopped being sold.
Yes.
Because the men were going to work, taking their paycheck, going to bars, coming home and doing domestic violence, hurting the children, spending all their money. But they blamed the alcohol, and they did that. They passed prohibition. Didn't change anything. Everybody went illegal. And I didn't learn, because being a mental health counselor, you go into that and you study emotions. You study culture. You study parenting. You study, well, how does a good little kid turn so bad? Did his parents do it? Was he abused? Was he just, and some people get caught, well, you're just like grandpa. You just look like, and you get a name from a family member. And so I started discovering there was a lot of mental health training going on, child development, parenting that was horrible. I used to teach court-ordered parenting to court-ordered parents who abuse their kids. They know nothing of child development. They know nothing about bodily functions, how to talk to kids. Some of them, you know, some of them are very well educated. But you don't talk
family. Absolutely.
You don't talk family. That's silence. That's none of your business. Just keep your mouth shut. And for a long time, children, they had no rights. They were to be silent, just like women. The men ruled. And it was culture. It was faith. It was religion. We're all looking at Afghanistan. They are running it according to the Quran. Now, they're going backwards into the ancient days, okay? But if you look in the Bible and you look at the Old Testament, that's exactly what they were told to do, because it's a flesh creature that has no, he has not gotten his flesh under control. my eyes, I see a woman's skin and I want to have sex. Or I see a child. So I got to cover you up. Okay? And because I don't have internal control. And years ago here in Florida, they discovered in juvenile delinquents, they were trying everything they knew how to help with mental health, medication, jail, detention, parenting, and it wasn't working. And they realized there was nothing internally, like a spiritual something in there to help them. So they went to the pastors in the church and says, you got something that you teach, that you help people to control themselves, to forgive this hate, this abuse, to, okay? I just watched an excellent movie called Steel Toes, free on YouTube. It was about a neo-Nazi guy. He's in a country, and he beats up some guy of Asian descent who's a Hindu. He gets a Jewish lawyer. These three people, they're trying to help this young guy. The Jewish guy was told by his father when he was a child, evil things happen to us in the world. We can only overcome that evil with love and forgiveness. And so here comes a Jewish man to defend a neo-Nazi. And what broke the neo-Nazi was a letter of forgiveness and mercy from the Hindu guy. Now, he still had to go. Excellent. I do a lot of that. But you don't know when you're young. You just get born into a family. You have no idea what's there, what their parents' life was like. You have no idea their issues. And typically it spills over. You don't know the role of the female and the male. If you get in, there's a partner, two females, two males. They have domestic violence and they have kids. And you don't know when you're a child. You don't know why that happens. And nobody's talking. And nobody's saying anything. And you get through it. And so understanding the code of silence, the military, everybody has it. Every family has a code of silence. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about that, Uncle. They don't know what's going on. Harvey Weinstein, we don't talk about it. Okay? So you have to be one who's willing to look, and you're not going to get a lot from family. Every once in a while you might get a deathbed confession, okay? But you're not going to get people that either, Joyce Myers is a great one. She got abused by her dad. Her mother did nothing. Why? She never knew. Okay? And you may not ever know why they don't protect and leave them and stuff. Why does some lady mm-hmm. stay with a person who's beating them up? Okay? Aren't you intelligent? But see, maybe they grew up as a child and that's what they're familiar with. They know the rules of that game. But I don't want to be alone, and this is love. So when you are helping people, you must know your own life. You must know a lot. I have to know that when I'm helping somebody, I don't have to ask them any questions. Because I already know every person that comes into my life got issues. Their parents had issues. Their grandparents, they all got issues. I don't have to ask them all these questions that everybody, they don't have to tell me their story because I'm not interested in it, okay, and all the details. And I just watched a video about how when you retell your story over and over, you actually do a lot of triggering in your own brain, and you set off neurons and dopamine and this and the flight or fight syndrome through the memories and the storytelling. I'm interested in healing. You're not a child anymore. How long have you been in therapy? Who's your life coach? What are you doing now? What books have you read about this? Okay? We talk about forgiveness. Well, some people don't believe in forgiveness. Okay? They don't think it's valuable and stuff. And I want them to go to jail. Sometimes that ain't never going to happen. Okay? And a lot of people, when you get into the ministerial world, forgiveness frees you. you're the only one getting punished. The other guy's gone on. They don't know nothing. They don't care anything. They moved on, dead, and here you are still.
Yep.
And
exactly right.
They don't want to go there. Some people want to become a lifelong victim because you have to feel sorry for them. And I can't work, and I need money. I need you to support me. And there's a lot we used to have, I think they were called lingerers in psychology. They get hurt at work or something. They never want to go back to work. They get money and social support. I have to ask people. God can heal you. But if he heals you, you got to give up your social security disability. You got to raise your children right. Go to work. Okay? Can't do all this complaining again. Can't keep telling your story because it's over with, done with. Okay? And they don't want to do that. Some people don't want to get hit. My brother was one. He was what you would call, he was diagnosed as a borderline personality. What it means is you got a lot of your personality is still a child. You don't want to be responsible for anything. It's not your fault. It's somebody else's fault. Take care of me. You owe me. And then the other part's sort of an adult. It is. He's a grown adult. And he was
I see that every day. It's amazing.
Those personalities all the time. And he didn't believe it. He just thought he was manic depressive, so he took medication for that. But he was also diagnosed, and he didn't believe it. But I had to look, go, well, how come he didn't want to raise his kids? Didn't want to pay their child support? Didn't really want to work? Wanted mom and dad to take care of him and pay all his bills. Why? He's trying to get back at them. He's always blaming them for his problems. Okay? They may have got started when he was young, but at some point, you know, you have to say, what is going on with me? And you can say, and some people, it is culture of the family. It's culture of the community. It's religion. It's the faith. I do a lot with religious abuse. You get into like the Amish or the Taliban. Everybody's familiar with them and their laws and their culture and their religion and the community. There's a difference between New Orleans and over here where I'm at Pensacola. We're military. It's totally different than New Orleans. Okay? It depends on what's in New Orleans. Oh, a lot of voodoo. Catholicism, Cajuns. Well, where'd the Cajuns come from? Up north.
That's
okay?
Right.
It was French. Okay?
Yep.
Catholic. And it's told him, I'm in a military town. We get everything. We don't have that.
Hmm.
So, but what you grow up in? You grow up in the swamps of Bayou, and your best friend's an alligator. Okay? Now, you might be smart, but your beliefs and how you deal with life and people, it's Cajun. But if you grow up in the inner city, it's different. If you're Mexican, it's different. And you have to take all culture and sects. You have to understand people from a spiritual side. They'll tell you, well, what's corruption? It's lust. What's greed? Lust. It's in the heart. It's in the mind. Where does that come from? I see something that I don't have, but you got it, and I want it. Where does that start? Kids, I want your toy. I don't have one. It's happened. It's played out in front of parents, and they don't know. And so you throw sex into the mixture, and it's still, as Carol would tell you, a taboo subject. Parents, I had no classes except, I think we had some sex education in the about a few things, but nothing emotional, okay? Nothing about dating. Did you hear first base, second base, third base, you know? Okay. All right. And even our language about sex, but dating, it was strange back then. I don't know what it is today. And a lot of girls, you know, they wear some scanty clothes, and they have no idea what it's doing to the boys who are lusting through their eyes. And they're really using their strength to get the boys, okay? And the boys just think that they are the toughest thing that ever was, honey. You put a beautiful girl with beautiful smell and perfume, and they just puppy dogs in her hands, okay? Even if they don't mean to be. A lot of competition goes on between the girls and the boys, you know. So I had to study a lot. I watch a lot of movies. I read a lot of books, true stories. I studied stuff. I go to Books for Millions, and I'll go into it. Because I had to work with the occult, and I had to work
okay,
with
okay, hold on a second there. Deborah, I want to say something about that. Okay. Because studies do show, okay, and this has to do with the stores and the people they purchase the clothing from, the scanty clothes that you're talking about. There was a study done on that some years ago. And, you know, they bring out all these outfits. And then the young teenage girls, they see them and go, oh, look at that. Yeah, of course they're boy happy. And the guys are girl happy. We all know this. So they see these things, these maybe the short. I used to wear short shorts and short skirts, of course. I wanted to be like the rest of them. I wanted to look, you know, sexy and all that stuff for the boys. That's just life. But they're blaming, too, the industry. I think that's the word I'm looking for.
That's
yeah, industry.
Yeah. Yes.
Because they bring out all this stuff. Yeah, they bring out all these clothing.
Okay. A mother, because she was an officer's wife. You couldn't wear that kind of stuff. I was taught how to dress elegantly, to go to cocktail parties, to be around generals, how to be elegant, because she was a wife of an officer. It was expected of you. So what kind of family you are born into will determine, and even at the day, I went through the 60s, banned the bra, blue jeans, okay? And women were trying to become free. Is culture and companies a part of it? Yes. Are movie stars, rock musicians, people in movies, are they a part of it? Yes. It's everything. The company, like in the military, there's rules. Dad wears a uniform. You can wear, I don't think I ever saw my mother in short shorts. I never wore pants, blue jeans. I wore dresses because that was my upbringing. So depending on, typically it's the mother who is either been influenced in her childhood and stuff, and she's the one that you go to Walmart, and she either, no, you're not going to wear that. Little girls don't do that. We don't do that in our family, okay? That comes from mama. That's part of mommy. The dad, okay, and believe it or not, if you ever study men in construction labor, they want an elegant lady, okay, because it lifts them up to a higher circle than where they're at with the men. They're not comfortable with it because they're around sort of more crude-type language people. But you'll see so many movies of them being attracted to an elegant lady. Our parents, okay, our culture, what movies we watch, what videos nowadays, all the dancing and the everything, different cultures. If you go into the black culture, they wear different things. If you go into the Asian culture. So where you get born in, that culture you get born into, has a lot to say how you dress, how you interact in relationships, whether child abuse is normal, abnormal, if you talk about it, don't talk about it, you know, all kinds of things. And so you have such a mixture component parts played into the abuse of a child. Some children say, I thought this was normal. I thought this is what everybody did. You know, I didn't know any difference. And they'll survive. They'll go into multiple personalities, disassociate. They'll have out-of-body experiences. Later on, they might turn to drugs and alcohol, and then they'll take it out on their own kids. They'll marry somebody like that, or, you know, all kinds of things happen. When you are...
Let me ask you something. I want to stop you for a second there. Mm-hmm. All right, what you're saying is there's a lot of truth in that. In fact, I had a friend. I still have her. After all these many years, when we used to sing in New York, I told you, and as teenagers, we're still friends to this day. And we know I'm not a teenager anymore. Okay, so she came from a military family.
Mm-hmm.
And the father became, that was his profession, was to be in the military. She hardly saw him. He hardly came home. She was one of, excuse me, three children, though. He came home somewhere in there, didn't he? All right. She was one of three children. And the mother picked out the clothing that, you know, that they should wear.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more, it wasn't in style. Okay, I'm going to put it that way. It wasn't in style because in those days, that's when the short skirts and the hot dresses and the hot shorts and all that other stuff.
That's, yeah.
You know, came into be because of the industry. This is what the industry was flooding the market with, and this is what the kids wanted, okay? So then,
okay,
therefore...
That's true.
So these kids, this gal I'm talking about, she and her sisters, there were three girls, they felt awkward. They felt different. They felt like they felt like they were, you know, being mistreated by mommy because, after all, they couldn't, you know, even have one short skirt or, you know what I'm saying, or anything that was, like, popular, okay, what was popular for that day and age. Well, she started stealing, and she'd go out of the house, and she'd get down halfway the block to the school bush, behind a tree or whatever, and she'd change.
Here's what happened.
What she
okay,
did.
Here's what happened. Is yeah. The mama is really has some knowledge about what's appropriate. But she doesn't know how to teach that to her children. And why wearing what is popular? Well, they get to wear lipstick at 8. Why can't I? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the
That's
mother
right.
and the father must be educated, well able to communicate why that's inappropriate. And if you're in a culture like the military, your wife was to be a college graduate, educated, but never work outside the home. Never. You were to be available to go to cocktail parties, meet the generals, Pentagon, whenever, whatever is necessary. You had to be elegant. A lot of mothers are trying, but you know the power of pop culture, videos nowadays, songs, movies, the pressure is tremendous. To be accepted, to be liked. They're talking now about Facebook. They know this Instagram causes mental health and suicide of teen girls. But they're going on with it. They're taking a pause right now because it pits their appearance. Well, the parents have to be able to be knowledgeable of what, we'll say, a teenager or a preteen is going through and how important social friends are. And the importance that culture plays on a child, the desire to be accepted, okay, and liked by their friends, it becomes so powerful. You will do just what you said. They'll go out and steal the stuff to wear it, and they'll go against the parental laws. So they're already what we'd call lawbreakers, disobedient to parents. So the parent is not explaining to the child. They don't have an understanding of this young person's desire to be like the others. I was around pop culture. I didn't think it was appropriate because I was an officer's daughter. I hung out with people from Saudi Arabia in high school, Ireland, Greece, Ethiopia. I traveled all around the world. I knew the necessity of talking properly, learning how to go to cocktail parties, sitting at banquet meals with foreign dignitaries, dancing the waltz, how to sit and go through a buffet line and a cocktail party, because I experienced that and I had. My mother didn't really tell me. I would read Emily Post's book on ethics and manners.
I even bought my son
a book about being a gentleman. Because some things, okay, I'm not a male. But here's a book on how you should dress, your haircut, you know, this kind of thing. So parents are important, but they must also have an understanding of the pull for young people to be accepted by their friends. And they must talk. They must talk about the birds and the bees. I didn't get that either. Okay? But I had made a vow. I knew I wasn't going to have sex till I got married. And I didn't.
Okay, now what are you talking about here? Hold on a second. What you're talking about is complete and total structure, okay?
Yes.
And structure, I think, is very good. And boundaries, too. Yes, and boundaries, too. But the problem here lies, okay, here, let me finish my sentence. The problem here lies is that many kids come from backgrounds where there are no boundaries, there is no structure.
That is correct. That is correct.
And then they end up, you know, making a lot of mistakes because, look, we're the survivors. A lot of us have been out on the street, okay, and because we had no boundaries, we didn't have parents that cared.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't set examples,
that's right.
All right? And why they're important to have examples or boundaries, all these things. And if a kid grows up, and the people who come on the show came from backgrounds, many of us, probably most of us, who didn't have that structure, who didn't have those boundaries. Now, what I do think. Okay, is that you reach a certain point in your life, and how many times have we seen this online? You know, we cannot let our past define who we are today, but it takes a while for us to get to that point. Yes, there are people who just want to live off the system.
Okay,
that's true.
If you encourage people to watch that movie, The Steel Toe, free. It shows you the neo-Nazi. We don't know anything about his childhood. Okay? He hated Jews. You know, he had all that stuff. What it took was somebody who this neo-Nazi hated, the Jews, and blamed for killing Jesus, to stick with him. The only person that was fighting for him. He's an adult now.
Mm-hmm.
Went against his family because he knew to help this young boy, he needed something. And the Jew was willing to give it love, companionship, treat him as an intelligent adult, even though he didn't graduate from high school, and the Hindu man, who offered a letter of forgiveness and mercy. Those two men, neo-Nazism, the hate in that young man. And he realized, and he went into court, and he told the judge, this is a problem with young people. This life that I lived and this belief that I had, this hate and this anger, okay, he didn't talk about how he got there. He says, you need to help us do something about it. He got into recovery, got into Bible study, got into, he was in prison for a while, but he was a changed man. And it was through people caring, providing love, forgiveness, support. When I help people, I adopt them. I say, you didn't have a mama? You didn't have a father. And if you did, they were horrible. I want to be your mama. And when they say yes to me, they are giving me permission to speak into their life as a parent, to train them, educate them, correct them, rebuke them in plain way like they didn't get as a child.
That's right.
And to teach
them. That's right.
Now, in the mental health world, you're just a client. You're just
That's right.
a 50-minute thing. I can have no relationship.
You're a number.
Totally different. What these
yeah.
people
and
need
many
are
times
Sora
zined out. Many times Sora zined out,
What
too.
They need
Listen.
Is reparenting. And they need to go back and be retaught
mm-hmm.
what's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You should already know, how did they get there? Oh, everything in their life helped them
mm-hmm.
to get there. And they're a mess. Okay? And you
but
have
in the
to
mental health
to...
field, wait a minute, we have to stop here for a second. You have to realize, though, okay, because I worked it too. Now, listen, a person can be born into a family where there's mental illness. We know this, okay?
Yeah, I was.
And, yes, and you were. So what I'm trying to say here is, yes, with those who are bipolar, yes, with those who are schizophrenic, yes, with those who, although with schizophrenic, many times they become even more schizophrenic because of terrible behavior at home. With those who suffer from all different kinds of maladies that we speak about at times on this show, it isn't always because, of poor treatment at home. A lot of times it is hereditary. We know this. We know that it's hereditary. It's in their genes. And then those who are borderline personality disorder, those are the hardest ones to treat because they display all of the disorders. One week they're bipolar. Another week they're schizophrenic. And then you have to try and medicate all of those different things. It was
mm-hmm.
like an octopus. It was that's how
mm-hmm.
it was taught to me.
Right.
And that's the worst of all of the disorders. Now, with these kids that grow up in homes where there's all these people who are mentally ill, okay, maybe it's the mother, maybe it's the father. With schizophrenic, usually it jumps a generation, usually. By the time
Sometimes.
You're 18 years old, yes. By the time you're 18 years old, you know, you're starting to display, you know, certain signs of being mentally ill. Sometimes it's before that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's things that you have to take in consideration. It's not all black and white, okay?
I used to believe that, Carol, that mental health
I don't
health
think
was,
it is.
And I'm just a big believer now. Okay, even
mm-hmm.
if it is genetic, God can
mm-hmm.
heal you. Okay, even if it is genetic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Even if
mm-hmm.
it skipped a generation and
mm-hmm.
everything the mental health people say is true, I have
mm-hmm.
to have a belief as someone who helps people the Lord's way that there is healing. Now, it may take time, a lot of teaching, coaching, prayer, a lot of study and research on their part. Okay? I've
mm-hmm.
read enough true stories about people getting healed. When there is love from the call it the therapist. This wonderful true story I read years ago. This girl was severely abused in her family, the only one by her mama. She grows up, she gets with a psychiatrist, she pays her insurance,
mm-hmm.
right? And once her insurance mm-hmm. runs out, they quit seeing her. So she finally got another one and her insurance ran out and she was expecting him to say goodbye. I said, no ma'am, I love you as a human being and you keep coming to me. And you call me whenever you need me, because I'm not going to
mm-hmm.
let you go. So she got that, and God started healing her at home from multiple personalities. And I asked God, I said, God, what is going on? He didn't read the Bible to her. He didn't pray with her. She didn't believe in God. He said, I work in the atmosphere of love. And when that psychiatrist generally loved that person as a human, and
mm-hmm.
said, I'll keep working with you without any pay. He said, I'll work in that atmosphere, and I'll get the glory, and I will do the healing that she wants, that the psychiatrist is trying to help. Just, oh, they didn't pray to me, but I can do the work. And I learned a big thing. That's why that movie with Steel Toes, it's about love,
mm-hmm.
the power of forgiveness, to change a life of whatever causes neo-Nazism and the hates of the Jews. And for a Jew to stay in there with them, it wasn't easy. Okay? You learn the power of love. So, we get them messed up, totally screwed up, from every way possible, every force, everything. And I had to go from mental health thinking to from medication. There's got to be a better way. That there's got to be some hope for healing. And you can overcome it. You can be healed. It can be put in your past. And it took going into the ministry and learning it about the power of love and forgiveness and being a mama to these people who didn't get the mother, the anchor. This is biblical, of the soul. It anchors the soul of the child in love, forgiveness, acceptance when they're at your breast and you're breastfeeding them. If that's not there, or it goes away, like you said, and there's issues, or genetics kicked in, you know, and genes, and the mama doesn't know anything about this, throw in abuse on top of that, that bond has now broken. The child still wants the love of a mother, feels rejected,
of course,
feels abandoned, feels abused, even if there has been no abuse, feels unloved, unwanted, and that will produce hate, do all kinds of bad things in the brain, thoughts. So I have to know that. So when they come to me for help, I become mama. I ask them, would you like to be my child, spiritually, you know? They go, yes. I said, okay. Now I have a right you've given me by your free will, a right to speak to you as a mama and to teach you and retrain you and keep going to your therapist, take your medication just like you're supposed to, you know?
As long as it's
question,
stable.
Please?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
And so
is it okay
I
if I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
John, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't. I just while you're on this topic, you know, and this is so important. I'm glad that you brought it up because, you know, over the years I've noticed exactly what you're talking about as far as going, you know, to the right people at the right time, you know, for the right reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you know that. So many people come in from different angles, so to speak, right? You have some that were abused physically, mentally, sexually abused, you know, and then you got different levels of it also, you know. And one of the main things is about people coming forward, period, you know, to get them to come forward, you know. And that's kind of like, you know, having somebody that you can go to and trust. And that's the issue, I think, with a lot of them is that the trust has been broken, okay? They don't trust anybody, you know.
I don't
and that's
blame
a hard
them.
Thing to overcome, you know. But, you know, with you know, the same thing that you were talking about earlier about, you know, going to really, like, understand people and you know, being that great psychologist with somebody. And you really got to be, you know, empathetic, you know, basically on every situation that comes before you. And you have to expect any situation, you know, and that takes a professional to actually receive that and actually do something for them, you know. So I really appreciate what you're doing for everybody, too. You know, it means a lot to everyone, you know. And I do the same thing on a different scale, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You can be, you don't have to be a therapist. Sometimes we learned in mental health, a lot of healing gets done over your fence. You're with your neighbor. Okay, and therapy, mental health wants to think they do it all. No, they don't. You see them 50 minutes, maybe twice a month, to put you on medication, go have a life. And when I was going into the crisis stabilization unit, do you know where most people spend most of their time? In church, with church people, if they're believers, in the community, at ball games. Okay? They're not with their therapist. You can have a best friend. People are getting healed like dogs because love is flowing.
Yeah.
And people, sometimes, that's all they need. Just unconditional love. But a therapist doesn't really love them. Right? Just like Carol said, a number, you pay my bills. Can't have any contact with you. Don't call me after hours. Mm-hmm. I stayed up all night with people before on the phone. Okay?
That's why I'm the night owl. Go ahead.
They need a mama.
Yes.
They need to call home. Okay? And therapists doesn't do that. They stay very distant. And a lot of them have been abused. They find out human trafficking. A lot of the people trying to help the kids, they've been abused themselves, and they've never been healed. Because you get into that gritty stuff, do you know how many hard, gritty, true stories I've had to read about abuse, human trafficking, teaching a child to kill another child and Satanism, cut their eyes out, eat their hearts.
We're
going to
have a show on that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay? I had to learn because they lived through it. I would get stories. They were afraid to tell me about all what happened. But I had to read and put myself and see what they lived through as children. So when they started telling me, it didn't freak me out. And I had to know what it did to the soul, to the brain. I studied Manchurian Candidate, okay, and what trauma and torture does. You go watch that movie with Frank Sinatra. God shows me moving. You watch The Matrix. Neo couldn't believe he was the one, but he had to have a Morpheus, which means God of dreams, and the Trinity loving him to help him get there, to believe he was the one to stop the war. You have to have people in your life that will stick with you, that love you. I've had them try to shoot me, stab me in my own home, poison me, because I just love them. That love has to be more powerful than anything. And most therapists don't have that. They care.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to see the people like they are. But their training is, it's a biological disease. And only medication can sort of minimize it. Shock therapy. They used to do lobotomies to try to fix people. Okay? Because they know there was something wrong. But to believe it was a spiritual thing or God had anything to, that is superstition, and science and reason had taken over. I had to work with people that are under attack by voodoo priests. And they'll sit there and say, I think I'm being attacked. Because I don't want to serve voodoo and Satan. And I'm being attacked. And if you tell somebody, I have pastors. If I tell them I hear God's voice, they think I'm mentally ill. And I'm hearing voices. So you have this disconnect between these helpers. You have one over here, it's all biological, take your medicine, and there's no cure. There's no cure for schizophrenia, which they don't even know what causes it. And then you've got some people that will just give you the word, and then there's some people that are genuine healers and will love. And God will work, like that movie, The Steel Test. He'll work through two people if he has to. They didn't even believe in Christ Jesus to help that neo-Nazi young guy change his life. And you have to see the power of love. And that's what a mama is supposed to be to the child at first, the anchor. Then the dad comes along, because he's usually gone a lot. His voice is different. His eyes are different. And slowly when the child feels safe, has enough safe interaction with dad, it can start trusting dad. Mom has a role. Dad has a role. And the child needs both of those in their life. They need a loving relationship. They need discipline. We know that, okay? And they need talking to and communication. They need a proper culture, and they need to have hope. They need, and parents, they're not there. They don't have the they don't have the parenting skills. Half of them
right.
are
and
the kids
Pastor
themselves.
Deborah, can I ask you another question, if you
sure.
don't mind? We have about 15 minutes left, and I just want to ask you one more question. And looking at your whole life, I mean, wow, you know, very, very impressive. First of all, do you have a book or plan on writing a book one day, maybe?
I've written all my stories. Okay, if you want to know more about me, go to my website at www.agapeloveishere.org. My bio's on there. All my stories, all my stuff is there.
Okay.
I have a YouTube channel with a lot of and it's called The Hidden Kingdom. I have a lot of videos. I tell my stories. I teach. And I tell how people, I went from being a licensed mental health counselor, state certified, nationally clinically certified, to helping people the Lord's way. And it took a long time. Because, you know, I had to have a master's degree, state license, nationally certified, was in private practice, worked in hospitals, worked in psychiatry. I had that level, and God is using both. And, yeah, you need a good therapist. Some people need medication for a long time. And it's okay, because that's an important part of us. That biological body needs to be in balance. And it and there's hormones. There's cortisol.
Right.
There's adrenaline. And when they get out of balance, we need them in balance. People's diets are not good. Their health is not good. They put alcohol in, too much sugar. And so you need somebody that can also the soul part of us, which is your thinking and your emotions.
You know, in the last thing that I wanted to ask you, and you know, it's going to be the rest of your night, and I really, really appreciate everything you're doing. It was nice to meet you. I want you to know that everything that you're doing in life makes such a difference in everybody else's life, you know. And the question is, I'm looking at your whole life, and it looks like a mirror image of where you are and what I do, but on a different basis, okay? Because we see the same people a lot.
Uh-huh.
And well, how much of a role did the way you grew up, okay, affect where you are today on a level or a scale that you are today?
Okay.
In other words, you know, you came through all of that abuse and stuff, and now you are, you know, just like an encyclopedia. You know, you're very, very smart. I'm like blown away, you know, and I'm like, okay. So, you know, how much of a role did that affect you into becoming who you are today?
Okay, number one, being in the military family, there was a atmosphere, you're a fighter. We're freedom fighters. We will give up our life and go to another country and die if we have to save other people who cannot be free. We will put our life on the line for other people. We were disciplined. Dedicated. Well, I lived on military bases most of my life. I am not a part of any community. I could care less about football and concerts. That's not where my heart is. My heart is freedom fighters, special ops. Put me in behind the enemy lines to set an entire continent free, like World War II. That is what I got from being in the military. Just as a dependent. And the discipline of the family and the wives and the children. You're never attached. You're government issue. You're not a part of any state. I never knew what the football teams were. I wasn't interested. If you tell me somebody's being oppressed, being in, you know, like Nazism and stuff, boy, I'm ready to go. I gave up everything.
So y'all basically just live in a totally different focused world, huh? Than everyone else. Yeah. On other things.
I could care less about ball games. So I'm gonna start. We got abused people that are slaves, they're oppressed, they're vexed, they're held in captivity in their minds, in their emotions. And I take my background. I'm to be a freedom fighter. To go set them free. I got a great song on my front page of my website by Gomer Pyle called The Impossible Dream. You reach and you'll be battered and bruised. You'll give up your loved ones to set somebody else free. And that was instilled in me in the military family. And you help people. You cannot help themselves, though. The only model I had was what my father was a psychologist. And at that time, for a female, it was social work. I did IQ testing, but I didn't like the nursing, you know. But you want to help people who need help, who can't get free without I tell people on my website, I have a video that talk about it took freed people who were not under Nazism and to gather together as partners and allies to go set an entire continent free. So I have this background. I'm a freedom fighter.
And okay. Let me say something to you here, honey, all right? You did a fine job, and you had a good rapport there with John. You're answering his questions. He's never heard you speak before, I don't think. Now, the show is almost over, and there were people that wanted me to mention just one thing, because I'm going to narrow it down to one thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. It's about teen suicide. I have, 4 minutes? I just want to get this out, okay? And this is actually come from the Mayo Clinic. Those who already have psychiatric disorders, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, family history, like we were talking a little bit about, of mood disorder, sexual abuse or exposure to violence or bullying, drug addicts, being gay, I don't know why that's there, but being gay, this is from the Mayo Clinic, or bisexual, they're not sure of their sexuality, let's put it that way. Being adopted, that really blew me away. In the United States, girls are more likely to try suicidal attempts, but boys are more likely to die by the suicidal attempts. All right, they're not attempting, they're doing. Now, these ages are from 12 to 17. That's horrible. Okay, 12 to 17-year-old kids, this is from the Mayo Clinic, okay? And also the CDC does mention some of this. So when someone asks me to talk about something, I like to, just mention it quickly. And a cluster of suicides in Las Vegas, one that was really atrocious, they're the rise in youth suicide attempts observed in the ER rooms, and this is from NPR, is rising. So people out there, just quickly, if you have a child who is persistently negative all of a sudden, frequently crying due to feeling hopeless and depression, all of a sudden having problems at school, loss of interest of activities, running away, drug and alcohol abuse, low self-esteem, too interested in their smartphones, hello, addiction, reckless behavior, and all of a sudden starts giving things away. That's a biggie right there. I saw that in detention and actually caught a girl who was going to commit suicide. I just knew it. I think our antennas are up once we try ourselves. So anyway, I just wanted to get that out there. CDC.gov also gives out an awful lot of information about adolescents. And that's what we're worried about, too, are the adolescents. And I just also want to give out the suicide number for people. That's 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. If you feel like your child is in crisis or is exhibiting some of the things that I just mentioned, with the negative moods and just changing, all right, and giving things away to simplify it, and their behavior is reckless all of a sudden, they are not happy kids, all right? So just keep your eye on your children. And there is help out there, absolutely. You bet there is. And by starting to get that help is to call that number, 1-800-273-8255, and they'll explain to you what to do, because our time is almost up. So I want to thank Deborah for coming on this show. I think I have 3 minutes, Jerry. You have 3 minutes. Do you have something of hope that you can give people? Yeah, you have a good 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. What I always try to stay in my mind is there is hope. Now, we know people are going to die. That's just life, okay? And being a minister, if I can get to them before and they still go ahead and commit suicide, which I have been with people who have done it, I have had to say goodbye to people. I'll see them on the other side. So they're really just leaving their physical body. So I look at death differently. But at the same time, I've worked with a lot of suicidal people. And what I have to ask mm-hmm. them is when they come to me, do you want to live? And usually the answer is yes. They may not have the hope to do it. They may not have the strength
right.
to do it. But I say, you hang on to me. Through me, you will get the hope. You will get what you need. Because usually the hope is, nobody loves me. I can't solve the problems. There's no mm-hmm. use. I'm in too much pain. And they haven't been able to connect to an animal to find the
mm-hmm.
love that filters to them the strength. And so they're missing that. And even if
mm-hmm.
they've been in therapy or they're married or whatever, they become hopeless. Sometimes it is a cry, please help me. Something's wrong. I don't know. And so some people will use it as a cry for help. But suicide,
mm-hmm.
it happens, okay.
Yeah,
it happens to young children.
Yeah.
It happens to
mm-hmm.
adults. You can do suicide by alcohol, suicide by drugs.
Yep.
Okay, there's all ways of, you can eat too much sugar and you are committing suicide. They don't call it that. And so you have to understand death when you're a helper. And you have to understand life, and you have to understand the soul, and you have to understand
mm-hmm.
what causes people to get to that point, even a teenager, because they've
mm-hmm.
probably been there for years and years, and it comes the first 5 years of a child's life, it's all at home. And then you throw in the bullying at school. But you get bullied.
Right.
When
you've
got
right.
brothers and sisters.
That was one of the things. Mm-hmm.
You get bullied by your brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it starts there,
mm-hmm.
and it gets carried on. And sometimes people just call you dirty, you know. I've heard parents yell at their kids, if you don't get me that, I'll kill you. You're no good. You're not. You're
yeah.
just like your dad. Words are
mm-hmm.
containers of life or death, blessings or curses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And some bad words. Maybe you came out and they wanted a girl and they got a boy. They don't like it, or they don't want what you pay. So you as a helper have to know all that and be there just to love them
mm-hmm.
and to be anchored for them. And like what you do, Carol, you're there for them at nighttime when they
no
need
way.
To talk.
Yeah.
And that's what they need, that connection to a live being who loves them unconditionally
right.
without question. And it keeps them one more day, just one more day. And eventually, if you can sort of get enough gasoline in them, you know, they're not spitting and sputtering about out, and their battery's getting recharged, you can guide them to help, to therapy.
That's right.
To program.
That's right.
But first,
mm-hmm.
some of it's just pure life support, you know, and it's because you took the call, the gun was there. The pills were there, but
that's
because
right.
you answered the phone and they
mm-hmm.
got a live person that loved them, they'll go one more day.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
that's how important having NASCA, having that contact list and you being there, or the suicide helpline,
mm-hmm.
just a voice on the phone. And I took crisis training to be on the phone
mm-hmm.
to know how to talk to people in that condition,
oh, yeah.
how to just say it. Sweetie, and I love you, and you are loved, and talk like that. Not to get a lot of information. Some just need to hear genuine love,
mm-hmm.
like you do.
That's right.
So that's what
mm-hmm.
I have. So NASCA is almost like a suicide hotline.
Well, we have a hotline.
So,
I mean, I consider
I totally
it like
agree
a hotline.
With that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we have people available. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and now in mental health counseling, they don't give out their private.
That's right.
Numbers. I do. My private
well,
number
we only
is my
have
business.
60 seconds left. Yeah.
All right, so you did.
Wait, that's what we
month.
Do at NASCA, too. That contact list is very important. Yes, it is. And thank you for coming on. And, John, I'm glad that you met Deborah. That's good. So
yeah,
I want to thank
it,
you for.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah. No, she's very smart. Sometimes I call a doctor. But anyway, all right. Okay, everyone, it was an interesting show. Good night. God bless. And tomorrow we'll have a guest on. And Thursday night will be Michelle Bliss, who will be speaking about demons. All right. Okay, good night now.
Good night.